Welcome back, guys. DGS. Happy Friday to you. Gorgeous weather out there. A few minutes past 4 p.m. This is when we typically do our Friday Fish Smackdown, but we have a champion for the first time ever. It's ICD out in Darden Prairie, Phoebe's alma mater and her church, and they'll be here in a few minutes to take the possession of the Golden Cod. So
it's a beautiful trophy.
It is a beautiful trophy.
I've been protecting it for a couple weeks now at my desk.
Debbie Monterey been trying to get it?
It's safe, yeah. I have to fend a couple people off here.
Well, that's how people are.
It was Ackerman.
So we had, oh, God, that guy makes me mad.
He was trying to take it to Jupiter with him.
He did it.
So our guests were George Mahey and my son Nick. I went to dinner with Nick last night, and he said he had a blast doing it. And Kurt Bellin, who is the owner and chef of Izumi and Rachel's boyfriend. And so we had, I really enjoyed it. It was a really good run.
Yeah, it's been a fun fish fry season for sure.
So I am, I've always been weird about Japan, just really, really into it, and like the feudal system of the 15th century and things like that. And Rach also, as long as I've known her, she's been watching the most boring content about people making eggs in Japan and things like that. And I'm like, so the samurai, they had the feudal system, and she's like, so watch here. This is where she poaches it. I'm like, yeah, that's super cool, man.
A little too accurate.
So Kurt is here with us now, and he brought us some of his famous Sando sandwiches. So Kurt, take it away. Tell us what we're having here.
Yes. So I brought in the fruit Sandos, which are fruit sandwiches. Basic formula for that is fresh fruit of different types, very nice cloud-like whipped cream on a special type of white bread called shokupan, or milk bread, that has a very special texture, and I think that's what makes a Japanese sando an authentic Japanese sandwich.
Let me give you the best compliment I can.
Okay, yes.
If this were not a Japanese delicacy, this could be the best South Roxana white trash food I've ever had in my life. Like white bread, Miracle Whip, and fruit. This is like when you get a spanking.
Yeah, it's so universally good. It's kind of like I'm cheating. So the number one fruit sando that I sell is the strawberry sando. And that's strawberries and cream. The second one is peaches and cream. Mm. And, you know, those are just such good universal flavors. You know, Japan or in Afton, Missouri, you know, you're going to have a good time with that.
So where do you find this in Japan? What level of food is this in Japan?
Okay, so you can find it many places. Primarily, the most locations are the convenience stores. They always have a wide selection of pre-made foods. Definitely, they'll have at least one or two of these fruit dessert type sandwiches available at any convenience store. And, you know, if you've ever been to Japan, they're literally on almost every corner, these convenience stores. And so you could always find them there. You could find them at like fruit parlors, these shops that sell maybe high end fruit. And then they also have these fruit sandwiches. And sometimes you'll find shops that just do fruit sandwiches, like in Tokyo Station, for example.
And so you have told me, and Rach has told me, that fruit is a big deal in Japan. It's a very common gift. It's a very appropriate gift.
Yeah.
And it could just be like, this is the prettiest pineapple I could find. Thank you for your hospitality kind of thing.
Yeah. Just in general with the Japanese supply chain, when it comes to different food products, especially domestically grown food products, there's a lot of attention to detail, a lot of perfection going on. So there's just a higher end of, you know, more premium fruits, if you will, available sort of thing. It's less of a commodity so much that, you know, if it's sometimes for a housewarming gift or just putting it on the, you know, a relative's kind of the shrine at home for their, you know, anniversary, basically. It's just a very nice gift to give someone.
Wheels, what do you think?
Can I stop talking and just eat the pineapple?
Have you not eaten it yet?
Not yet, no. Well, I had one of these before and it was like heaven.
Nerd.
Well, I don't want to be chewing into the microphone.
For the love of God.
I'm gonna smash these things during the break.
Andrew, did you get the Nutella one?
No, I don't. I'm not a big Nutella guy.
Ooh,
I went with the regular
Nutella's
whipped cream because I do love whipped cream.
Can I say one more thing about the strawberry sandos?
Yes.
So when we were in Japan, we went to this like 5-star lounge and, you know, they give you like a glass of champagne when you walk in and they have all these unbelievable treats, like, you know, patisserie laid out, and they had strawberry sandwiches. And I thought that was so interesting because you can find them at the convenience store, but they're also such a delightful treat that you're going to find them in a lounge like that. Yeah. And I do think, I mean, I am biased because he's my boyfriend, but I do think that Kurt's were better. I mean, he put so much effort into making these, like getting an Izumi Sando is like getting a little piece of art and getting a little gift to yourself. It's really nice.
I agree. It
tastes better than art.
Wow, how professional, Wheeler.
That's my review.
Yeah, do you know how much paper mache he's eaten in his life? A lot.
Dude, it's just in the way, so it's going.
So when you do you do your pop-ups and you do your yakitori nights.
Yes.
Tell me the difference between those.
Okay, so the pop-ups, you know, that introduces this konbini food, which is pre-made sandwiches, also these rice balls called onigiri. And these different snacks and drinks. And it's a definite, more of a daytime sort of vibe. The yakitori pop-ups I do once a month in the back of Platypus every first Saturday night, weather permitting. And that's a little bit more of a drinking bar food for sure, this yakitori. Because it's usually the way you do it, if you go to like a smaller yakitori shop, you know, you'll get, you know, maybe six skewers and a drink, a beer. And you drink the beer, eat the skewers, get more beer, and it's just a very nice pattern to fall into.
Is yakitori in Japan, would it be the hamburger of America? Would it be the pizza? Would it be both put together?
Yeah, I mean, it does have a big spectrum because it is a very common kind of street stall food. You know, you just set up a grill. And you got your kitchen going, basically. So even in the smallest of little tiny hole in the walls, you could get a yakitori menu going if you have ventilation for the grill.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty much all over the place. And also, too, there's also, you know, Michelin star level restaurants that serve it.
So I was going to say, like, if I can do anything in a culinary way, I can barbecue and smoke meats because Nick and I did that for a long time and we traveled and we did competitions and you can't help but get better at something you do many, many times. So I'm a bit of a barbecue bitch in that when barbecue places open and everyone's like, oh my God, have you been to blah, blah? And I go and I'm like,
Yeah.
Are you kind of like that with like the yakitori and the Sandos?
Yes, very much.
Good man. Good man.
That's exactly. I mean, because all right, and it's not to like talk
crap
down
on
anybody,
right?
It's because the way I compare it is, if you went to New York, say, and you're like, I'm from St. Louis, and a really friendly person from New York was like, oh my gosh, I've heard about all this great food there. They have these fried ravioli, and they do this pizza with the provolone on it. Like, it's a little bit wrong in what they're saying and the details, but I would appreciate that someone would be interested in it.
Yeah.
And so when I say that, I don't know, some of the food, Japanese food that I've experienced in America, not just the Midwest, is a little bit slightly out of tune. It's not to, you know, discredit that or discredit any sort of Americanization of food, which is oftentimes delicious. It's just that if I'm trying to, you know, do this one thing, making these like these fruit sandos or these sandos and going and driving up to Chicago to get milk bread, it's a big part of like why I started to do this in St. Louis.
Gotcha.
Basically. Yeah.
So I know that obviously Japan's very different than the United States. Food's different. Restaurants are different. But in your travels, are cooks cooks and chefs chefs, and you guys kind of speak a similar language wherever it is?
Yes. Because one thing that's really interesting with a number of these Japanese different restaurants and shops is oftentimes they have an open kitchen set up to where you could see the cooks doing their things. You hear the waiters calling out the orders, and there's a lot of like open communication going on. And it's just really interesting. Even if I don't know Japanese 100%, which I very much don't, it's really interesting to feel the vibe of a restaurant in Japan. And it's you know, that same sort of busy, fun energy in a busy restaurant in St. Louis.
Yeah. So
it's very interesting, very universal.
What made you decide to do konbini food? Like, what made that so special to you?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well,
I was about to ask that.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. One of the biggest things is, so this was, I started this in the summer, fall of 2020. And basically it's always been a one-man show. It's been a one-man show since then. And just the logistics of pre-made food, like it capitalized on all these like kitchens kind of being shut down half the time. It allowed me to be able to, you know, crank out, you know, X amount of food by myself instead of doing it, you know, made to order. It's, you know, I would spend, you know, the 12 hours beforehand cooking all the stuff. So that was a big reason. Another big reason is that anybody that goes to Japan, especially for the first time, that's one of the biggest highlights of a trip. It's started to get a lot more steam talked about on the Instagrams and the TikToks mm-hmm. these days. But definitely that was, you know, of my visits, that was one of the things that stuck out because it's just one of those things you just don't expect to be as good as it is. And especially in such a hectic vacation, like a trip to Japan, you know, there's sometimes you're just awake before every restaurant opens and you just need something good to eat. And there's, you know, a 7-Eleven right at the corner next to your hotel, and going in there and just kind of like a kid in a candy store is a big experience for many people that have visited Japan.
So you're obviously very entrepreneurial based. What's your dream? Is it to be like the Harry and David of Sando sandwiches or to kind of really introduce them to St. Louis in the U.S.?
I mean, my biggest goal with this is to define a Sando for someone having it for the first time. You know, like, I'll try to explain what I'm doing to some folks and be like, oh, no, I've had those before. And it's like, did you really? Because, you know, in St. Louis, you know, there's not many places that have milk bread even. And so just trying to define something for the first time for someone, like, it's very important to me because, you know, I just don't want to, you know, just be hanging around a bar in 5 years and be like, oh, man, this Japanese Sando was so good. And it had, you know, it was on this white bread, on Wonder Bread. It was just, you know, the whipped cream was all runny and good and gooey. It's like, that's not quite right. And so just trying to define it, trying to be memorable with a little Japanese fire truck, like, that's my biggest thing. I've seen so many great restaurants come and go that, you know, really all I want to be is remembered.
Have you seen the movie Big Night?
No.
You're Tony Shalhoub.
Oh, okay. Yes, I've heard of this movie.
You
I have not seen it.
Just cancel your date with Rachel tonight and just go home and watch
okay.
it.
Okay.
Because you are Tony Shalhoub.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That's a nice compliment. Yeah. I've heard good things about
people come into his amazing, authentic Italian restaurant and order a baked potato with the pasta, and he refuses to make it. And very similar.
And it's that sort of thing to where it's like, I really love American sushi. Like, I want to put that on the record. I'd love a deep-fried, like, tempura Philly roll.
Caterpillar roll,
yeah. I mean, it's good. But, you know, if someone is like, oh, this is exactly what they're eating in Japan, it's like,
yeah.
Almost.
You know what's a real shame? I lived in Alaska for 3 years, and they have some of the most amazing sushi. And the very first couple I got were like, what is it called? Nigiri, too much, right? It's like the very first taste of alcohol you have is like an 18-year bourbon or something.
Okay,
and I didn't eat sushi again for like 10 years.
Yeah.
So stupid. I should have started out with baby steps.
I mean, especially desserts, when it comes to desserts in any cultures, like black licorice or some of these Japanese candies, it's like there's just some things that are like it seems to be, and it's not brainwashing, but people are just more accustomed.
Yeah.
That's their concept of, you know.
So people are intrigued. People want to eat your food. What do they do? Do they follow you on Instagram? Is that the best way to keep up?
Yeah, that's the best way. I like to, you know, I don't do much marketing, and there's only so much I could do being a one-man show. So I try to find the right people and tell the story instead of just, I don't know, just showing up at a busy festival. So
what about a private party?
Not yet. But eventually I've had plenty of people reach out, but
what about a private party with really rich people where money's no object at all?
No.
Wow.
Because that's the whole thing.
He's Tony Shalhoub, man.
I'm not doing it for money. Like, I mean, maybe there's everybody has a price, but you know, that's if I was doing it for money, I would have grown this. I would have scaled up way bigger. I would have got that nice angel investor, maybe money bags to open up 3 fast casual things. And it's not in my business.
Thank you. Very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
She's gone. Welcome back, guys. DGS. Okay, not a great deal of time here, but not a whole lot to do either, because we have the champion of 2024 DGS Catholic Fish Smackdown, ICD Incarnate Word Darden, and we have Gabriel here, who runs the whole thing. Gabe is from San Antonio originally, didn't know what a fish fry was in 2019, and here you are running the whole thing, and you're the champ. Congrats.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, so tell me about coming up here, not knowing what a fish fry was, going to one, and then running it.
Yeah, so the first year, my uncle actually works the fish fry still, and he's the one who told me, hey, I need you to help out on Fridays, show up. I'm like, okay, yeah, sounds good. And then a year later, I ended up basically falling into the position.
That happens.
Then, yeah. COVID happened, right? So the previous leadership stayed on for a little bit more. And then finally, 2021 is when I fully took over. And now we are here. We're champions.
What one? What if you have a secret, what is it? And then secondly, feel free to take a few seconds if there's anyone out there you want to thank.
You know what? The secret is the people that actually work the fish fry. It takes a village to run one of these. So I don't know if you guys know, but we do around $30,000 a night, okay? That's 3.5 hours. So if you do the numbers, it's a lot. We serve anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 families every Friday. So we actually eclipsed over $200,000 in sales this year. So
congrats.
The my speech at the end of every night after we finish, I tell all the volunteers that, hey, look around. You see how many people there are? That's how many people it actually takes to run one of these. So we really appreciate all the help that we get. And that's one of the big things that we always try to strive for is, right, is try to make sure that everybody understands that this is a group effort. It's not just, you know, me or the parish or the people that actually are in the crew. It's everybody that makes it a success.
Congratulations, so.
Congrats,
ICD,
guys.
Well done.
2024. See you next year.
Yeah, awesome.
Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. Happy Friday. So a serious topic, but a hopeful topic. In studio with me, we have Winston Henry, who is the executive director of Gateway Foundation and the Caseyville location. We have Clint Hamill, business development coordinator. And we're talking about recovery. We're talking about addiction. Just been talking to the gentleman a little bit off the air. So just so you know where I'm coming from, I don't know anyone my age whose life hasn't been touched by addiction in some way. And mine certainly has, probably more than the average bear. And a little over 2 years ago, got a call from my son, who is about to turn 30, who is just the best, right? Everyone loves Nick. And at the time, it was COVID, and he was working at Total Wine. He'd been a big, you know, college partier kind of guy, gotten into bourbon, you know, working at Total Wine, the allocated stuff, and we're getting bottles of Weller 12. And called me one night and said, I need help. Drinking problem. Try not to get upset. Next morning, had him into recovery. 28 days later, doing great. 2 years later, doing great. So near and dear, right? Near and dear to me. And so I'd like to know, first of all, professionally, personally, what brought you guys into this line of work? Please.
Well, my name is Winston Henry. Again, I'm the executive director, and I've been with the Gateway Foundation for 30 years. And personally, both sides of my family have suffered from addiction. I'm going on 32 years clean myself. And so that got me in the line of work. I want to help people. I want to let people know that we do recover. We can change. We have to buy into the system of what the fresh professionals can help us with. The mental health part, the substance abuse part. And being able to take that to daily living. And so what I've been doing, I worked in the community-based programs in Illinois. I worked in the Missouri to help with some outpatient services before. I worked in the youth care programs for Illinois and the corrections for Illinois. And so I've seen a vast majority of what addiction has done from 13-year-olds to 71-year-olds. And so it doesn't discriminate with age, race, gender, creed, or anything like that. It will take a hold of you. And it affects the whole nucleus. Like you just said, it affects the parents, the husband, the wife, the kids. And so we have to find a way to build the bridge for education, not just with the person that's in services, but the person that when they go home to, what can we do to assist them as well? And so we try to make that as a part of our programming, where we do, you know, prior to COVID, we had family visits, we had family sessions. Since COVID, we've been doing more Zoom sessions with them and trying to get them acclimated back to a normal day living, you know, because when they leave, some of them have been married for 20 years and they got kids, so they're not just going to go get a divorce. So we got to find a work this pattern out with all of them together. And so we're excited what we do. We're starting to implement more of the mental health services than what we have when I first started. And that's really a blessing to be able to bridge those two components together, because once the person gets off the substance, there's some mental health, there's some trauma, there's some PTSD, there's something that they've been masking over. And so I think by putting all that and having therapists that are trained and educated, it really makes a value for us as an organization.
Maybe you can talk personally or just from experience or both, but it seems to me, because I certainly have my issues, which I've been very open and honest with about on the show, chemical addiction has never been one. So for me, when someone says, I can't stop drinking, I can't stop using this drug or that drug, I understand the words, I sympathize, I empathize, but I don't feel it. Mm-hmm. For someone like you who feels it, been there, so much of it is, it would seem to me that that person who needs help thinks, oh, I know there are some people who can get help, just not me. Mm-hmm. You don't know what this feels like. You don't know how hard this is, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That has to happen with almost every person who ends up getting help from you guys.
It does. It's on a day. I mean, the reason we was a little bit on a delay just now, because we was dealing with two individuals that believe that they're cured. And so without trying to throw personal stuff with them, because I want them to be able to understand what addiction is, not just because they see me and that I'm in this process of where I'm at in my recovery. I'm trying to give them the education on it to understand what it does to them with their dopamines, with all the parts of their bodies. You know, you've been drinking for 30 years. You could have cirrhosis of the liver. You could take another drink and you're dead. Or you got 7 DUIs. The next DUI you might get, you might kill a whole bus load of kids. And so I try to break that down. And some of my staff that are not in recovery, we try to get it to more of the science of it, to let them see the whole process of what addiction has done each step of their life. And sometimes when you're dealing with families that say, you know, I don't know why this person do that. They're from a good home. They got a great job. They got a great this and all this. And then we try to get them to educate their self, you know, outside, maybe some, their own therapy, and to see how this has not, it's not because you was a bad wife or a bad husband. There are some things that your child or your loved one has done, whatever it might be, that they might not be talking about. They might not be truly talking about, and it might not be so significant where it's bigger than somebody else's, but there's something. Because that, you know, I got a young man that he's 26, he's been drinking since he was like 3. You know, and started doing meth when he was 10. I mean, that's not common. So we got to break it down. Why'd you start? Which I talked to him. It started because there's some dysfunction going on. So you got to look at the whole magnitude of what this has came to be with an individual that's 26 and they've been doing meth since they was 10 and 11.
So we're talking to Winston and Clint from Gateway Foundation, about 17 different locations within the sound of my voice here. Others outside of that, inpatient, outpatient. Like I said, I've had some experience with this with family members. Clint, before we started, I asked you guys, so how should people judge you or any other recovery center? When my dad went in a nursing home over 20 years ago, the person we met with was shiny and happy, and it turned out not to be that shiny, happy of a place. Live and learn, right? Mm-hmm. And you guys said, talk to the people who've been through it. And you guys have like a 98.6% satisfaction. I would recommend this to a friend of patients who've been through the programs.
Yeah, correct. That's a big number. And yeah, I'm the shiny happy, but I've got stats to back up everything that that we do. And the clients, the patients that we have come through our programs, when they leave, every single one of them fills out a satisfaction survey, not done by us, and it's sent off. And so the numbers that come back, we don't see what these things are. Nobody's sitting with them to fill these out. It's all on their own, and we do that on purpose. And having a number of 98.6% of the people that come through would recommend it to a loved one, that says all you need to hear.
Yeah.
So that's a major issue.
So it seems to me that for a situation like this where people are listening to KMOX and it's drive time, it's almost 5 p.m., and they hear this, either it resonates and they want to turn the radio up, or if it's very bad, it resonates and want to change the station, right? We understand both mm-hmm. situations. For people out there who it resonates with, whether they're turning it up or down, either they're the person who needs help, or maybe even more importantly, it's someone in their life. Best advice we can give them on a Friday afternoon. What should they do?
Well, that's. I'm glad you brought that up, because they're either going to turn it down or they're going to turn it up. And so the individual that's turned it down, then we know there's probably some issues where it's something that has hit home with them. Either they have lost a loved one and they're blaming, and not saying purposely, they're blaming a institution or a facility because my loved one couldn't stay sober, couldn't stay clean. The ones that's turning it up, reach out to us at Gateway. The ones turned it down as well. You know, they can reach out to us at Gateway over in Caseyville. I can get anybody in treatment in Caseyville, Illinois, Carbondale, Illinois, Springfield, Illinois, and Jacksonville. For sure, those facilities, as long as we're not at capacity. So my facility has 44 beds. Springfield has 108. Carbondale has 48. And we can make things happen to try to save people's lives today, because it's bad now. I mean, fentanyl is in everything. So people are ODing and they don't even know why. They're smoking cannabis, gummy bears that have some traits of fentanyl in it now, you know. And so it's a scary thing. And so if you're turning your radio down right now, please turn it back up. Mm-hmm. Please turn it back up so you can hear the message. There is hope out there, you know, but you have to reach out to ask for it. The people that's turning up really loud, give us a call so we can try to help to save your loved one, and give them some education, and even yourself, you know. Yeah. If they just want education, their self, they can call in.
And last thing I want to talk about is not every facility is what I would call a full service facility. You probably have a different professional mm-hmm. name for it. But I know that when it was my son, the first few days to help out, there were prescription medications. Mm-hmm. And some places aren't going to have that. It's going to be a lot harder road to hoe.
Correct.
Yeah, we do have medically assisted treatment. That is one of the options. And each one of our locations does have a psych doc and a regular MD, so there's a full checkout before you get going.
Very good.
Can I piggyback on that?
You sure can. Yeah, go ahead.
So a lot of our patients come in with a lot of anxiety and depression, and so we have medication that can help with those moments, because the first 72 hours are rough. They just left their best friend. It's called Jack Daniels. Mm-hmm. They just left their best friend called cannabis. You know, they left their best friend that was masking all this over. We taken the mask off. Now we have to find something to help these individuals deal with those emotions. Most people want to run. You got to stick and stay. You got to stick and stay. And we have that MAT program at all of our sites that can assist with individuals with depression, anxiety, if they're going through withdrawal of alcohol, of opiates. We have medication that can assist in that area.
Numbers, websites, gentlemen.
GatewayFoundation.org.
Very good. And my little part in it, although I have not suffered through this myself, I've done it with loved ones, and there is hope. There is help at the end of this. So reach out. Again, happy Friday. Quick break, right back. DGS, GatewayFoundation.org.